That's Tara Ragavir, Homes Guarantee Campaign Director at People's Action, speaking to us from Kansas City, Missouri. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Thank you also to Sanji Lopez. Check out our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Secretary of State says we have to do more to help communities get safe water. Young people in Portland and across the country are fighting for the climate. And an asteroid just barely misses hitting the Earth. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 26, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Tribes and rural communities in Oregon are among those who are struggling because they do not have access to safe water. That's part of the message from Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan today, as she announced the results of a new audit.
I'm a child of rural Oregon. I was raised in Duffer and the Dalles, and I prioritized this audit during my first term because of what I've heard from tribes and other rural Oregonians about the need for the state to address the current and future water shortages in Oregon. I'm not going to mince words today. Water is life. And these findings in this audit report are truly shocking. Communities across Oregon do not have access to reliable, clean water today. In central, south, and eastern Oregon, Oregonians have dealt with limited water and competing interests for a long time. In recent years, it's developed into a full-blown crisis. West of the Cascades, communities are also struggling. Growing demand, improperly regulated agricultural and industrial practices, and increasing water temperatures are putting people at risk of experiencing water insecurity in the future. Our federally recognized tribes are unable to ensure that their people have access to clean water. And across the state, we are not immune to the mega drought that is incapacitating other parts of the western United States. Oregon has a reputation for being rainy and wet. But that is a very Western Oregon-centric reputation. I'm here to tell you that we need to be very concerned about water security, both east and west of the Cascade Mountain Range. Many of you have reported on these issues before. Thank you. What's shocking about this report is it shows that there's no plan to address the problem. As I said before, water is life. If even one family doesn't have access to clean water, we're failing. When entire communities struggle with water access, it's a crisis. I think we are in a crisis right now, and it's only going to get worse with ongoing risks such as climate change, growing populations, and aging infrastructure. So today I'm offering the Oregon Legislature and Governor Kotek a roadmap to create a statewide plan to address water security in Oregon. The advisory report we're releasing today provides a roadmap for how they can do that. The report we're releasing outlines several problems with the way Oregon handles water governance. First, it notes that we don't have a statewide plan. We do not have a coherent funding strategy or shared priorities. Second, it points out that we don't have the necessary data to support regional planning needs. Third, the report makes it clear about the lack of broad and diverse community engagement in water decisions. And finally, the report highlights the difficulties that our federally recognized tribes in Oregon experience as a result of ongoing industrial and agricultural practices that are ecologically inappropriate for Oregon's water basins. The report creates an actionable roadmap that leaders in Oregon can take to address these issues. These steps include developing a statewide governance model, broadening community engagement, and improving data data collection, and more. The advisory report from the auditors is detailed, it is nuanced, and most importantly, it is actionable. In summary, we need a dam water plan. Far too many families lack access to clean water today, and many communities in Oregon are at high risk of becoming water insecure in the very near future. So I'll say it again, this is a crisis. Water demands urgent action, and this report gives legislators and Governor Kotek the critical information needed to immediately begin work on a statewide plan that will ensure every Oregonian has access to clean water now and for years to come. The Audits Division has done incredible work, as always, in this report that could make a real difference in people's lives.
That's Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan. An asteroid just missed grazing the Earth today. But as KBOO's Josh Salem explains, NASA scientists were not all that worried.
A truck-sized asteroid passed the Earth today in one of the closest such encounters ever recorded. NASA was sure it would be a near miss, with no chance of the asteroid striking our planet. This newly discovered asteroid flew by 2,200 miles above the southern tip of South America. That happens to be 10 times closer than the man-made communication satellite circling overhead. The closest approach took place about 30 minutes ago. Experts say we would have been safe, even if the asteroid had come much closer. Most of it would have burned up in the atmosphere, though a few of the bigger pieces might have landed here as meteorites. NASA used its Impact Hazard Assessment System, called SCOUT, to rule out a strike. Despite just recently noting the asteroid, it was able to predict in advance there would be an extraordinarily close approach with Earth, but not a collision. Discovered Saturday, the asteroid known as 2023 BU is believed to be between 11 feet and 28 feet across. The Earth itself will drastically affect the asteroid's path. Our gravity will move it into a much longer oval orbit around the Sun. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Young people are getting more involved in the climate fight, including in Portland. Eric Tegedoff has that story.
Local governments are looking to the youth climate movement to get young people engaged in civic action. Youth climate councils have been established in cities across the country, including in Portland, giving young people a chance to influence municipal governments on climate issues. Nancy Deutsch is director at YouthNex, an interdisciplinary center that promotes effective youth development housed at the University of Virginia. She says young people can be assets in the fight against climate change because they come at the issues from a different perspective.
Adolescents are actually really much better than adults at seeing creative solutions, in part because they're open to risk-taking more than adults. And so I think it's really important that youth and youth climate councils are at the table.
Deutsch says young people are leading this movement because they will bear the brunt of the damage from increasing temperatures. She also notes that people under 18 aren't able to vote, and so these climate councils provide an outlet for civic engagement. This legislative session, Oregon lawmakers could mull a proposal to allow people to vote starting at age 16. While the councils provide an outlet for young people, some have felt sidelined in these organizations, including the Portland Youth Climate Council, where members have struggled to connect with city policymakers. Deutsch says in order for youth climate councils to be successful and not discouraging, the onus is on adults.
Adults have to be willing to listen and take action, and the adults have to make clear what is on the table for the youth and what is not in terms of policy change.
Deutsch says another benefit of the councils is that it allows young people to exercise their civic engagement muscles at a younger age.
If that experience meets those developmental needs, that's much more likely to become incorporated into how they see themselves and therefore the way they will continue to act in the future because it's become a core part of who they are.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A new report card gives Oregon some high marks, but also some failing grades in its efforts to protect lung health. I talked to Carrie Nissen with the Oregon Office of the American Lung Association.
We've been doing this report for over 20 years now. It's a report that comes out every year, and it's a report that takes a look at evidence-based policy areas that we know if states and the federal government implement these areas, we will see an impact on our smoking rates and our tobacco use rates. And I am so proud of Oregon. We have really come a long ways and really made some progress the last couple of years in our grades. Although it still has one F on it, it's a report card that looks much better than most states.
Yeah, I noticed that even Washington State's grades were quite a bit lower.
Yeah, absolutely. The one area that Oregon really shines is tobacco prevention and control funding. Through an initiative to the people, we, you know, made an investment in our public health, and we are dedicating tobacco dollars that come in from the state to reduce the deadly impacts that tobacco has. And I always say the best cessation program, the best quit program, is a good prevention program. If we can stop our youth from ever using tobacco products, from ever starting to vape, that's going to be the best way to create a healthy Oregon that's free of tobacco addiction.
And you made a special note about the ordinances that passed in Washington and Multnomah counties to restrict the sale of flavored tobacco products. Why is that so important?
We know that youth are particularly drawn to flavored tobacco products. I remember back in the day, my dad was a smoker, a cigarette smoker, and it just smelled bad. There was just nothing attractive about it. These new vape products, they smell good, they taste good, and too often, youth don't even realize that there's any harm in using these products. So you've got kids who are sharing their product with other kids, and sometimes it can take just a few puffs of those products and someone can become hooked to nicotine. So it's really a path to initiation for our youth to use tobacco products and become addicted to them very quickly.
So what you would prefer to see then is a statewide ban on these products, right?
Restricting the sale of these products is really the only way that we're going to make a dent in the consumption of these products. Flavored tobacco products have been around for a long time. They've been enticing, you know, generations. And what we're seeing with these latest products is some real egregious marketing products. We've got flavors like Cap'n Crunch, Cherry Bomb, Pina Colada. So these products definitely have that candy influence and that flavor and that color appeal that's really attractive to youth.
Tell me about the grades that were given to the federal government as well and what you would like to see the federal government do more of.
You know, the federal government could just be really more aggressive in helping us with the flavors. I know years ago when many of the flavored cigarettes were taken off the market, they didn't take menthol off. And menthol is one of those flavors that gets many people hooked to tobacco products. It actually got my dad hooked when he was in the Army. His first cigarette was not a flavored cigarette, and he thought it tasted horrible and was never going to smoke again. And then someone gave him a menthol cigarette. And that cool flavoring, that anesthetic feel that it had, that it was cooling, and it just made the poison go down. So if they could be more aggressive in getting menthol products off the market, we could really see some good progress across the nation in lowering our smoking and tobacco use rates.
Are you an Oregon resident yourself?
I live across the river in Vancouver.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So you're basically local. So that family history, was that one of the reasons that you ended up doing the work you're doing now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, sometimes we forget that tobacco is still the leading cause of preventable death and disease. And so many of us have lost family members and loved ones to tobacco use. And I had to watch my dad struggle with his very last breath as he had COPD. And that's the image that will always haunt me, but it always makes me get out of bed and run to work every day because I never want any daughter or any son to have to watch their dad go through what I did.
Mm. And was he also here in this area?
He was a dryland wheat farmer in Eastern Washington.
Okay.
So he had a tough life. It's not easy to be a farmer or a small farmer. Mm-hmm. But he actually did quit smoking when he learned that infants exposed to secondhand smoke are more likely to die from sudden infant death syndrome. And my sister at the time was pregnant with one of his grandsons. So he actually did quit smoking, but the health harms that he had done were irreversible.
As a country overall, are we making any progress on these issues?
You know, we are making some progress. We are seeing smoking rates decline. But the unfortunate thing is we're not seeing this decline benefit all communities. We still have elevated tobacco use and secondhand smoke exposure cause disproportionate harm to many communities. Communities of color often have higher smoking rates. Persons with behavioral health conditions often have higher smoking rates. And then we also see higher smoking rates among persons with lower incomes and lower levels of education. Our Medicaid population has higher smoking rates. So while we have made some progress in some areas, there's still a lot of work to do in many communities.
And do you think that the level of tobacco taxes should be higher?
What we know is one of the best ways to encourage people to quit smoking and to discourage our youth from ever starting to smoke is to raise tobacco taxes. Oregon just increased their tobacco tax a couple of years ago. We get a C in that category. We're at $3.33 a pack, and so we're actually ranked 7th in the nation for tobacco taxes. But there are some states that have higher taxes. So increasing tobacco taxes is always an area that the American Lung Association will support.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, considerable cloudiness and occasional rain showers after midnight, a low of 41. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with showers, a high of 47. Today in history, on this date in 1788, Captain Arthur Phillip guided 11 British ships carrying convicts to the colony of New South Wales, effectively beginning what became Australia. It's marked as the start of when the continent's indigenous people were gradually dispossessed of their land. Many call the date Invasion Day. The quote of the day is from Kevin Rudd. The apology opened the opportunity for a new relationship based on mutual respect and mutual responsibility between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia, because without mutual respect and mutual responsibility, the truth is we can achieve very little. A $100,000 grant will help pay for a California food box program. As Suzanne Potter explains, it's an effort to fight child hunger.
San Diego may seem like a wealthy area, but the mountain communities in the eastern part of the county still struggle with hunger and poverty. Now, a new $100,000 grant from Save the Children's Innovation Lab will fund the development of a program to mail boxes of shelf-stable food to low-income rural families starting next year. Anahid Brackey with the San Diego Hunger Coalition says the program has been a big hit in other communities.
The parents said, it's like Christmas. The kids feel like it's Christmas. You know, they get this food box, you know, it's for them, and it really helps supplement the whole household.
A team from the San Diego Hunger Coalition is at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, this week to learn best practices from other communities that have already implemented the program. The funds will also be used to train community health navigators who can help people sign up for programs like CalFresh and WIC. Esther Liu with Save the Children says mailing the food boxes makes more sense than asking families to travel long distances to pick them up.
There's little public transportation in rural communities, meaning that they then have limited access to grocery stores and places where they can get fresh and nutritious food. That makes it really difficult to provide the food that they need for their children and their family members.
Hunger Coalition data show that about 35% of kids in the Mountain Empire region live in poverty, which is nearly triple the rate for the rest of San Diego County. In a recent community food survey of local residents, almost three-quarters said they'd run out of food at some point in the last 30 days and didn't have the resources to buy more. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new study shows students are still struggling with pandemic learning losses. Edwin J. Vieira reports that's according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Students are still struggling with learning loss from the COVID-19 pandemic. A study from the NWEA shows 2022 test scores aren't rebounding to the same level as they were pre-pandemic. In New York, math scores sharply declined throughout the state, according to the Empire Center for Public Policy. But the issue goes beyond just test scores. The study also finds existing education inequities were only amplified by the pandemic. Elisa Villanueva Beard with Teach for America says this learning loss is also the result of numerous issues coming to a head. She describes it as trains on a collision course.
On one train, we have children who are not well, both from a learning perspective and also from an overall wellness perspective. On another train, we have a teacher crisis happening where teachers are being asked to do more with less.
Villanueva Beard says another issue is having an outmoded system that couldn't meet the moment. Some solutions she thinks will get kids back on track are hiring and retaining good teachers and providing students with equitable learning opportunities. But she feels one challenge to doing this might be a lack of innovation within the current education system. However, these are solutions to the short-term implications of the pandemic. Students have been facing problems with mental illness due in part to the pandemic. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 44% of students felt persistently sad or hopeless during the first 2 years of the pandemic. Villanueva Beard feels it will affect kids long-term.
We are living in a society where uncertainty is the only guarantee, and our children actually need to be able to be creative, have very clear skills around reading and math, computational thinking.
She notes a community approach must be taken to ensure kids fully recover from the pandemic in terms of social, emotional health, and educational skills. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
New Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo was the only Republican in the country to defeat a sitting Democratic governor in the 2022 midterm elections. Alex Gonzalez reports that some Democrats say he failed to address key issues in his State of the State address.
Some Nevada Democrats say the state's new Republican governor, Joe Lombardo, missed the mark on addressing key issues and putting forth solutions during his State of the State speech. Lombardo will have to work with a Democratic-controlled assembly, which could lead to partisan disagreements in the upcoming legislative session. Assemblywoman Selena Torres of Las Vegas is also part of the Nevada Latino Legislative Caucus. She says in her eyes, Lombardo failed to address crucial issues for the state, which include health care, housing, public safety, and clean energy. Torres says Lombardo didn't speak on what he plans to do to help Latino families in Nevada, which according to the U.S. Census Bureau is the second largest demographic in the state.
Focus a lot on what he's going to do for wealthy corporations and wealthy families in the state of Nevada. But I think we're missing key elements of what he's planning to do for the working class families in our community.
Lombardo did lay out plans to put away a hefty amount of state dollars in savings, cut gas and payroll taxes, and increase public school spending, as well as expand the controversial school choice program, something he received praise for from fellow Republicans. Torres says the caucus's priorities this session will surround health care, education, language access, and housing. She says Lombardo failed to touch on a number of health care-related issues that she sees as paramount going into this next legislative session, such as bringing more health care providers to the state. She also says abortion is clearly top of mind for Nevadans and voters across the country.
He had no plan for protecting women's health and reproductive rights. And obviously, this was a critical issue for voters at the ballot this election cycle. So it really was disheartening to see that, you know, these issues were not focused on.
Torres says she and other members of the Nevada Latino Legislative Caucus are ready and willing to work with those across the aisle on a number of issues to help Nevadans. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
House Democrats say they're being pushed off committees for opposing former President Trump. The GOP floats a plan to eliminate the IRS and impose a nationwide sales tax, and the House Speaker is standing by Representative George Santos, at least for now. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
It is about revenge. It's about appeasing the former president. All three of us have been a thorn in the back of the previous disgraced president.
Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota says it's not policy differences causing House Speaker Kevin McCarthy to keep her and other Democrats off select House committees. McCarthy plans a floor vote on whether to remove Omar from the Committee on Foreign Affairs, citing her previous comments regarding Israel. McCarthy says he'll also keep Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell from serving on the House Intelligence Committee in retribution for the removal of two Republicans from committees in the previous Congress after they promoted violent acts against Democratic lawmakers.
The so-called Fair Tax Act is unfair, unconscionable, and un-American.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says the GOP's proposed tax legislation is an example of the extreme mega agenda, which would eliminate the sole source of funding for Social Security. To win the Speaker's gavel, McCarthy promised a group of lawmakers a vote on legislation to eliminate the Internal Revenue Service and the U.S. tax system and replace it with a 30% national sales tax, though McCarthy himself says he opposes the bill. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky says conservatives and the House majority will not vote to raise the debt ceiling without significant budget reform.
President Biden says he won't negotiate over raising the debt ceiling. I have news for him. He absolutely will negotiate.
Paul says the greatest threat to national security is the national debt and that it will take compromises by both parties to balance the budget. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he is standing by troubled Representative George Santos of New York.
I do not have the power simply because if I disagree with somebody or what they have said, that I remove them from elected office.
McCarthy says Santos would be removed from his position should the House Ethics Committee find he broke the law after he admitted to fabricating much of his background. 2023 has already seen a record number of anti-transgender bills in state houses across the country.
The media calls it cultural war legislation, but to us in Oklahoma, we call it common sense.
Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt says his state's passage of anti-transgender sports and bathroom legislation is a roadmap for other states to follow. So far this year, more than 150 anti-transgender bills have been introduced in at least 25 states. Meta, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, has announced it will reinstate former President Donald Trump's access to the social media platforms. The company suspended Trump's accounts following the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, stating his posts could potentially incite more violence. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A West Coast state reaches a $2.8 billion residential school settlement with First Nations. And a land back effort pits Alaska versus the Interior Department. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The Canadian government has announced a multi-billion dollar settlement related to collective damage caused by residential schools. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the government says the settlement refers to unfinished business from 2 years ago.
The class action lawsuit was brought by two British Columbia First Nations. It originally contained several classes of complaints, but 2 years ago, all parties agreed to focus on the initial settlement efforts on survivors and their descendants. That, they said, was to ensure they would get compensation during their lifetimes. The lawsuit was launched more than a decade ago in a bid for justice for day scholars who were abused while attending residential schools, but who were not eligible for the 2006 settlement for full-time students. It also represents 325 Indigenous First Nations across Canada. It's the first time Ottawa is compensating bands and communities as a collective for the damages related to residential schools. Here's Crown Indigenous Affairs Minister Mark Miller.
While settlements that are being announced like these today do not erase or make up for the past, what it can do is help address the collective harm caused by Canada's past.
Miller says the settlement is being guided by several key issues: the revival and protection of Indigenous language and culture, the protection and promotion of heritage, and the wellness of Indigenous communities and their people. Individual bands will decide on which of those pillars to focus on and will develop 10-year implementation plans. Miller says the $2.8 billion settlement will be put in an independent, not-for-profit trust. More terms for the settlement will be released next month, and approval will take place at the end of February, followed by an appeal period. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A small lot in downtown Juneau is at the center of a dispute between the state of Alaska and the U.S. Department of the Interior. It's the latest development in a years-long land-back effort by the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes. KTOO's Katie Anastas reports.
Tlingit and Haida President Chalkyaish Richard Peterson recently signed a deed to place a small parcel of land into federal trust. It essentially creates Indian country, a small spot where tribal law would apply. The lot is less than 800 square feet. But Peterson says the decision is about more than just the land. It's about tribal sovereignty and self-determination.
These lands were unlawfully and illegally taken. Through the years, we've legally and lawfully tried to get them back.
The state of Alaska is challenging the decision in court, saying it undermines key terms of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act by creating a reservation. Rules around whether Alaska Native tribes can put land into trust have changed with presidential administrations over the last several years. Under the Obama administration, Alaska Native tribes were allowed to submit applications for the first time since 1980. And in 2017, the Craig Tribal Association became the first Alaska tribe to have an application approved. But under the Trump administration, the Interior Department withdrew the revision. Then, under the Biden administration, the department issued a new opinion, allowing land to be put into trust for Alaska Native tribes again. Peterson says the state's lawsuit is setting the relationship between the state and tribes back.
This endangers all applications for future land of trust for all tribes, not just Juneau, not just an urban center, but all of the rural applications.
The Interior Department also has pending applications from two other tribes in Alaska. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 26, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Edwin J. Vera, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at